I guess the first thing that I should ask you is, what is a marker?
It's a kind of a way of life, in a way. A marker is a way of life. It's what I think it goes on from the time you're a kid. It's what you owe people for what they do for you. You don't like to put it that way often, but that's the way it really is. Even when you're a child, if you do something good, somebody buys you an ice cream cone, you know, it starts that way, and it ends that way. It's always, what have you done, and what do I owe you? But it's not nice to put it that way. Most people don't like to say so, but I think people live that way. In the world of gambling, it's known as an IOU, just a regular IOU. You put your signature on a piece of paper, and that's a marker. And in the movie Little Miss Marker by Damon Runyon, it became known then in 1934 as she was put up, the kid was put up as a marker for a bet by her father. And it was a wonderful movie with Adolph Mahajou and Shirley Temple. So it was forever known kind of only as a gambling thing, but in the political world, and what I like to call the real world, it's known differently. Somebody does something for you, there's a marker out, and you owe him, and you better do it back. Because if you don't, you're some kind of a bad guy, you know, or, you know, that kind of thing.
And indeed, the term marker is rarely used, or rarely is it expressed in the Sidney Zion world of markers that this is something you owe. It's just understood.
Oh, if you say it, it's no good right away, you know. It's just understood, right? If you don't, if you got to talk about it like that, then that's a bad thing, you know. You got to say, you owe me one. I've got a marker on you. No, nobody says it, but they understand it. Because it's not something you put in writing, and it isn't like a bank. What it is, hey, you live in a world. You want me to do you a favor? Well, one day I may call on you, and then you better be there. If you're not, then you're some kind of a rat. You're a bad guy.
Well, and there's also a kind of hierarchical structure in terms of markers. For example, at the end, there's a grand flush marker. What is that?
Oh, yeah, royal flush. What the hero, one of the heroes of the book, Jesse Frank, the lawyer and power broker, wants is he's got an idea that if he can do something here, if he can actually do what he plans to do, which is to get the royal flush marker on the President of the United States, it will be, they'll all owe him. If he doesn't let them know that he's at risk in a situation where he can actually do something bad, he doesn't blackmail anybody, he goes to trial, he's going to win the trial and then go to the president and say, see, I didn't even turn your people in, knowing that I could have died. I could have been finished. But now he would own everything because they would trust him and the word would get around, not just with the president of the United States, but all the prime ministers everywhere. This is a man you can trust with your life because he put his own life at stake. Against that was a reporter named Mike O'Rourke in the novel who is going to try to stop him, though they were best friends for many, many years. For most of their lives, but he was brought up a different way, not to want that kind of corrupt world to go on. And that's the conflict, the basic conflict, overwhelming conflict in the book. Underneath that, you get a whole lot of subplots and a lot of fun, I hope.
Well, it is fun, and basically it's the story of two, I can't really say childhood friends because they met while they were
Yeah, they met a little later, yeah, yeah. Right.
But it's basically their story and the story of their parents. Yeah. And the newspaper reporter is kind of a Sidney Zion figure in a way, and the lawyer is kind of like a Roy Cohn, kind of.
Well, I mean, the lawyer
story's
too,
different,
you know.
But he's got that same sense of power, the party every year, and this sort of thing.
Some of that, but it's really not Roy Cohn, you know. It's not that. It's not a roman.
No.
And I wouldn't do that. And also, I was a lawyer. I wouldn't have known how to write this stuff about criminal law if I was not myself had practiced it. And I would wish that I were Mike O'Rourke because I think he's too good for me, you know. I mean, I think he's a better guy than I was.
I don't think so. Yeah. But did you practice law in New Jersey?
Yes, I did, and in New York, but for mostly in Jersey. I was a defense lawyer and then criminal defense lawyer and then a U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney, when Jack Kennedy was president. Bobby Kennedy was the attorney general.
Well, there are three dynamite courtroom scenes in this book. I mean, and it just,
hey, thank you.
It just, they just drip with authenticity. You can just feel it, the relationship between the lawyers and the judge and all of the finagling that goes on behind. Were these cases that you had something similar to cases you worked on?
There was a little bit. You know, I once had the major case is an incest case. Mm-hmm. And you don't hear about too many incest cases. When I was a clerk, in the days when I got out of law school, which was the late 50s, in New Jersey they had a system and had it for many, many, like forever, where you had a clerk for a law firm. They paid you next to nothing and sometimes nothing. But you had to do that for 9 months before you became a lawyer. And I went and clerked with a very good law firm, good trial lawyers. That's what I wanted to do. And they had an incest case. And I was working on it with, I didn't try it myself. And it wasn't like this. In other words, various things happened that didn't happen here. But it was I thought about it later on for many years. And I said, you know, one day I want to write about that, because you don't hear about incest cases where a man and his daughter, a man's accused of doing this with his daughter. And I said, you know, it's got elements in it. I'd have to change it a lot. And I did change it a lot. I fictionalized it. But, yes, that case did happen.
And then there was the case of gang rape.
The gang rape also happened. A little more like it, yeah. That also, when I tried that myself.
But it's interesting, the lawyer hero in the book, Frank, his first name is?
Jesse
Frank, is so shrewd and manipulative. He knows exactly what cards to play, and he takes chances, though. But is being a criminal lawyer like that? You take a risk?
If you're great at it, and I think you have to do that, of course. Because
it's so easy to crash.
Yeah, but you see, if you do it the other way, you lose. It's easier if you know the defendant is guilty. Then you can take any chance. Look, the thing is an ego game. The best lawyers know that and admit it to themselves anyway. They don't say that in public. But it's them against the prosecutor. And they don't think about the defendant so much as themselves. And if they think that they're on trial, they win. If they think the defendant's on trial, they can often lose. They have to wrap themselves around that guy in a way that the jury, if they like you, they'll let your defendant out. That's the way I try cases, and that's the way I try to present it here. I think there's all too little of that now. It was the way it used to be. Criminal lawyers, when I grew up, and there were a lot of great ones then, maybe there are now, but then they would try cases without taking 6 months to do it and 4,000 pages, 6 months, maybe 2 years, and without a whole lot of paperwork. They would just walk in, and they had an instinct for it, and they tried the case. And these people, the ones that were really successful, would get the jury to think of them as the defendant. And then if they liked them, they weren't going to put them in jail. That's the trick of it all. You have to have an instinct for it. You have to know how to cross-examine. You have to know how to do a lot of things, and you can't learn that. You can only learn a little bit of it. Most of it is, like, you can't learn how to be Frank Sinatra or, today, the late Sammy Davis Jr. You know, you can't learn certain things. And the plotting guys, they win a few and lose a few. Mostly they plead people guilty. But the guys that are better than that are the ones that really feel that it's themselves on trial, and they can't bear the notion of losing. It's like Vince Lombardi, you know. They can't bear it. The idea of that is so terrible to them that somehow it gets to the jury. It's infectious. And, of course, they con, and, of course, they do everything to make the jury love them.
Is that why these lawyers that in these prominent cases hold news conferences all the time? And
you know, we never did that.
I mean, I would
that.
Hate that if I were the client that had my lawyer going out and shooting off his mouth.
But we never did that.
They do it now.
Well, they do it. I think they do too much of it, and they hurt themselves a lot. If you do it, you do it only, you have to plot it out. You're not trying to get yourself in the headlines. See, that's the mistake. You don't want to separate yourself from your client. You want to be your client so you can win the case. And if they just go out on their own just to make money and put themselves on TV every night, a jury is not likely to acquit, you know. No, the way it was done in the proper way from when I was there and from long before, you didn't see all these great criminal lawyers holding press conferences. What they did was, when it was needed, they knew how to get the press, because it's important, since the prosecutor mostly owns it. The prosecution generally runs the game. When they indict, the big story goes in the paper, and you have almost nothing to say in return. So you have to work with the press. But to just make yourself the star and nothing to do with your client, I think is a big mistake.
No, it's bad. Particularly, this is a digression. It has nothing to do with the book.
Yeah, right.
And this Bensonhurst situation where
right.
Michael, what's his name?
Murphy.
Murphy is giving news conferences and has become an object. You know, he's been attacked a couple of times by crowds outside.
Nobody remembers the defendant. It's all Murphy now.
Yeah, but it helps to polarize the community.
Oh, I think that's a whole different world.
This should be a judicial. You should have some judicial restraint and stay inside the courtroom and not go out there and hold these news conferences and
look.
Get
I think you're right. I think the only time that it's okay to do it is if you're being overwhelmed the other way. If the prosecutor does it, then you got to do something. But to just do it in order to get yourself your face on TV.
The prosecutors, unfortunately for them at least, work within an institutional environment with a boss, and it's going to be harder for them to go out as a free agent to do what some of these defense lawyers are able to do.
Yeah, it's true, but sometimes prosecutors do overwhelm a case. They go out, and in this case, no. I mean, Joe Hines is not going on TV every day, and the other guy is. But generally speaking, you do have a problem when an overwhelming amount of public relations is going against your guy. You got to do something about it. But I don't think you have to go out there and hold press conferences every day.
No. How long did you practice law?
I practiced for 5 years in New Jersey.
In Patterson?
Well, a couple of years there, and then 3 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office.
In Newark,
right.
Where did you go to law school?
You know, these were years in which I was in court every day, so it sounds like nothing, but mostly I know lawyers that have practiced for 25 years that have never been in court. I was there every day. Where did I go to law school? Yale Law School.
As did Frank in the... No, he went to
Penn. I went to undergraduate at Penn. I switched it around a little bit.
I see. Looks like you have, you called upon a few markers yourself. You have a cover blurb here from Frank Sinatra.
Isn't that nice? Yeah, he sent that in to the publisher a while ago.
I'm glad he read a book.
He reads more than almost anybody I know. This is amazing. He doesn't sleep a lot. He sleeps 2 hours, then he wakes up, then he sleeps 2 hours like that. And he reads. He's more. He's got a library you cannot believe. He reads constantly. People wouldn't believe that, but it's the truth. He does. He's very well read.
How did you become friends with Sinatra?
Oh, I don't know, about 10 years ago. And we stayed friends and... over the years.
How did it happen?
I was doing a piece about music for the New York Times Magazine. It wasn't just like that I met him. And I wanted to interview him, and a good mutual friend arranged that. And we got along well. It was called The Return of Style, the music. The Return of Taste or something like that. It was the cover of the New York Times. Sinatra was on it as it finally developed. It was a reaction. It was like in late night, about 10 years ago, 9 years ago. It was when the old music started to make a little bit of a comeback against the constant and nothing but rock and roll. And I thought I'd look into why it happened that the music that we all grew up with went out the window and this all came in and no one could hear it anymore. Now that it was making a little comeback, it was a good occasion to take a look. And it was a very controversial piece. More letters written on that than ever in the history of the Times Magazine, ever, no matter what else they could write about the Holocaust and the Vietnam War and all. But this piece got so many people angry, especially the younger people. It took me longer, by far, to get it in than it did to write it, because I had all kinds of opposition with the 30-year-old people in the paper who couldn't bear the idea that anybody would say anything that indicated that their music may have been hyped to them and that this was the better music, you know, and this is what the piece essentially did say.
I have a feeling that the demise of the big band era coincided with the influence of the amplified guitar.
In a way, and it's funny because Les Paul was the guy.
You have three guys sounding like a band now.
Right, that's right, that's right. Well, that's how I met Frank, yeah.
How did you switch over? How did it happen that you switched over into journalism?
It just happened as a fluke at first. I was with a U.S. attorney in New Jersey, but at law school at Yale, Victor Navasky, who now edits The Nation, had put out, a thing called Monocle, which was a political satire magazine. This is in the 50s, 56, 7, and it was Xeroxed. I mean, I don't even know if there was Xerox said, but it was just like that, on that kind of paper. And Victor came to New York and decided not to become a lawyer, but to bring the magazine here. And he kept putting out the magazine, and one day when they had the big newspaper strike of December 62 that lasted 114 days, he called me up and he said, we're going to put a newspaper on the stand called the New York Pest. It's going to look just like the New York Post. Would you do a parody of Murray Kempton? And I did it. And then the Post called me and hired me. And I got a leave of absence and went there. And the first story I ever did was a front page exclusive, and I was hooked. And I realized that, you know, I always wanted to do this. My father always said to me, "Are you crazy? A newspaper guy? You could, you're a lawyer. Why are you? You're not going to do that. They make 25 bucks a week." This was then, you know. "Are you nuts? You're going to start like that?" And I listened to him, and I liked law too. But the minute I saw that, then the print got me, you know, and I couldn't. I never went back.
You switched over to the Times.
Then later to the Times.
You did a lot of legal work.
I covered the Supreme Court and all that, right. I covered the courts and politics, et cetera, right.
I guess that's how you got to become friends with Roy Cohn.
In a way, yeah, because I covered one of his trials and when he was first on trial. Then I was on the Post, right, and I went over there to see him because I really hated him, and I was hoping he would be found guilty, and he was waiting for his jury. And that was when an amazing scene took place that I recount in that other book called The Autobiography of Roy Cohn that I did before this. And by this time, most of the reporters had left him, you know, and he was just, the jury had been out for a while. And I walked over and I said, "Well, how do you feel about this, that you are now waiting for a result that you have done to everybody else? You destroyed all these people, and how do you feel about waiting for your own jury?" And he said, "Hey, you know, I love your stuff. You write good, you know, right? I hardly had written anything, but actually it hit my vanity." And I said, don't give me that. I'd like to say the same about you." And he said, "Let's go get a drink." And we talked for about an hour and a half. And in that hour and a half, while he's waiting for a jury, he's talking about everything I'm asking him, the Rosenberg case, the Hiss case, all that. And suddenly it occurs to me, because I had seen by then many, many people waiting for juries when they were defendants, and mostly they can't sit, they can't talk, they can't spit, they can't do anything. They're dying, they're praying, they're doing anything. And he was talking to me about all these other things. And I said, "Oh, well, this is a piece of work. I got to get to know this guy better." And then I did, and eventually I wrote the book about him. I never did agree with his politics, but I did have a lot of regard for the way he could operate in the world.
Yeah, it was incredible. He made he had so much influence and so many friends, and yet philosophically, he was denounced all over the place.
Yeah, right, because of the McCarthy thing.
Yeah,
but he that was a very bad period, indeed.
Yeah. And how did it happen that, but maybe you could amplify it a little bit, how did it happen that you actually wrote a book called The Autobiography of Roy Cohn?
Well,
written by Sidney Zion.
You know, because he died, and then I had to finish it, and I had to write a whole lot of things, you know, that my own analysis of the thing, because he was gone, and so it was his autobiography, and then the question is, do you say by? And eventually it was true. It was more true than saying with.
But he did present the publisher a 700-page manuscript.
Yeah, but we threw most of that away. Yeah, because it wasn't very readable.
Did you interview him, and did you tape him and get his own voice?
Oh, sure, for many weeks. So, yeah, we did a lot of work.
Now, Markers, is this your first fiction.
Yeah, right.
How did that feel after writing nonfiction all of these years? How did it feel to sit down there and say, "Well, I'm going to write a piece of fiction now"?
It was scary to begin with, you know, but then I got to like it a lot as I saw it develop and I saw I knew how to do it, you know. And you never know you know how to do it, but somebody tells you you do finally and you feel better about it. And then somebody pays you to continue to do it and then you really feel better about it. And then I loved it because it's wonderful to get into the whole world of imagination based, though, on a lot of things that you know. I mean, I think you can't. It's very difficult to write about worlds you don't know about. And I happen to be lucky because I lived in a lot of worlds. It wasn't always so lucky when I was doing it. And a lot of it I thought was problems. But finally, after 30 years of being in various worlds of politics and law and journalism, that I said, "Hey, you know, well, I know a lot of these people, and I like to write about them and the way they live on a certain level." And this is not the level of the lower middle class, though, of course, it comes out of that, because the people, the grandparents and all that come out of another world, but they develop people that live in a very high-rolling kind of world. And I think I know a lot about the way that works and the way human banality works and what goes on and how deals are cooked and made and what people don't usually see and what you don't read in the newspapers. What I was not able to often write in the newspapers because there are libel laws too. And like I say, though, it is not based on anybody particularly, but just on all the people I knew, and I fictionalized everything and had all the characters are not people that really lived, but a little different.
probably made composites out of many.
In many ways, yeah. You know, one day after I wrote the book, long after, I was watching a show with Orson Welles. They did a retrospective on, I guess it was TNT or something. They did a long, it's like 3 hours, and once in a while it'll show again. It's wonderful. And I'm sitting up 3 o'clock in the morning, and they say to him, the interviewer says, "What you were doing was realism, isn't that right?" And he said, No. Unreal, but true. Like James Cagney. He said, "You never saw anybody like James Cagney. There's no such thing. But when you saw James Cagney, you knew it was true." That's what he meant. And I said, "You know, I think I may have been able to do that, because there isn't anybody just like Jesse Frank or Abe Roshevsky, or, which is maybe my favorite character. But I think they ring true. I mean, it's bragging, I know, but I think they do. But they're not real. They're not real in the sense that I think the difference between a roman, and I don't know how you say it, aclef or aclef. I don't even know how to pronounce it. Yeah. I don't think, see, people that try to do that always fall flat, because they're just trying to do exactly the characters as they know them or they're in the newspapers. You just do that character, and you write him exactly as he is, and everybody goes to sleep, because they've already read that in the newspapers. You take people you knew in the world, and you just imagine them as they would be in other circumstances or whatever, and then it's not a roman, and it's a whole different thing.
Well, it's usually said that fiction is truer than the truth, that you can express things in fiction that you cannot express in nonfiction. And you yourself indicated that exactly, that there are libel laws and there are things you just can't say.
You can't say it directly, right.
But
also,
not,
you can't, because there's other reasons. In journalism, you're restricted by the rules of journalism, which are pretty good rules. You're not going to just become a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and imagine what somebody's thinking. Imagine the journalism we would have if, instead of just writing what somebody said, you wrote what he was thinking all the time. Now, you know, we don't have a license to do that. But in fiction, there's no question about that. You can do anything you want, and often you can get to a better truth. I don't think Dostoevsky would have been a great reporter, but look at him, you know.
Your sense of language is good. Over the years, listening to being a participant in court trials and interviewing people, I think you've picked up on the way people talk. In this blunt, rather violent way that many of us, particularly in broadcasting, tend to suppress.
Well, yeah, because it's all kinds of, you got to worry about the FAA or something, you know.
No, not the FCC.
FCC. I was just on an airplane, and that's why I'm thinking of that. That's right, but, you know, everybody's got to worry about something, but not if you write fiction. Mm. Then you can write the way you think it is very close to the truth.
This is probably a hurtful question, because I'm sure the hurt still lingers after the death of your daughter, Libby. Have you done much writing with regard to that?
No, I haven't done any writing with regard to that. I've done a lot of talking, mm-hmm. a lot of TV interviews and radio and interviews for the press. I can't write about that.
Yeah,
that kills me too much.
It's pretty well over now, isn't it? They never did anything to the doctors involved.
Well, that's not true, though. It's still up in the air. I mean, nobody knows yet what will happen. They're still waiting for final decisions from those disciplinary hearings. But then we have the civil trial as well.
That's gone for years now, right?
Yeah. 6 years.
6 years. Well, but one good thing happened. I understand that, particularly as a result of the Libby Zion case, doctors and interns and residents don't have to work these staggering hours that are debilitating and exhausting. I mean, these are new laws. I think they went into effect last year.
They did, and it's the only thing that came out of this that we feel good about. They lowered the hours significantly, and they made, also just as importantly, they are supervised now in the emergency rooms and on the floors. They can't just do what happened to my daughter, which is that understaffed and overworked and underachieved people who were just new were treating the most critical patients around. And in Libby's case, she wasn't so critical until they made her critical. But yes, hopefully it will spread all over, and it is beginning to spread all over. And then the question is, will we be able to enforce it? And that will depend on people. But there's been a lot done already, and that's the only good thing that came out of this, so it wasn't all in vain. And Libby's name is all over the world now that way, because they're studying it everywhere and trying to fix up a very bad system where, if in order to enable the medical profession to deal as they felt like, the patient was taken out of the equation. And so if they felt like having a practically a slave system, so they wouldn't have to pay much money to people, you walk in and you're dealing with somebody who just got out of medical school, treating you in an emergency room for the worst kind of thing, because you don't go to emergency rooms for a bloody nose. And this, I think, has been fixed in New York and is beginning to spread all over the country and the world.
Now, Sidney Zion, you whetted my appetite for more fiction from you. What about yourself? Are you planning to do some more along these lines?
Well, if this works, and if it doesn't work, I will do more. I'd love to do more fiction. It's wonderful because, you know, you can really let your imagination go, and then you don't have to sit in a room full of documents. The only research I did in this book was to call my mother a few times to find out how to spell a Yiddish word. That was all.
Oh, I believe you did your research because you had you went back a number of generations. These years had to match the character. They had to age in the proper way.
Oh, a little bit. Yeah, you've got dates. But actual, the way I really write, which is in a room full of documents when I write my other stuff, you know, I've got to be sure that not one thing is wrong. I don't want letters. I don't want lawsuits. That's a different thing than this. This, of course, you do check a few points to make sure that you're not, you know, you're not in the wrong years. You're not doing that. But that's minor. That's not research. That's just fun. You know, that's trivia.
Well, Marcus, it's a terrific book and an exhausting book because I finished it about approximately 3:30 this morning.
Don't say exhausting.
Most people don't read the way I read. I usually try to read in single sittings, and I don't recommend that. It's better to do it the way Frank Sinatra does it, two on, two off.
Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah, it's fun that way. Yeah.
Great book, Sidney Zion.
Thank you. Thank you very much.